All right, welcome to class today. Glad to have you with us. Before we dive in, are there comments, questions, concerns, or other things for me? Okay, just a little, oh, yes.
Is this about like the class or?
Sure.
You know how in like car passenger side windows it says like objects maybe closer than here? Isn't it like just a mirror? Like why
the Yeah, why would objects be closer than they appear? We'll get to this. Before I talk about this though, let me just mention a leaf logistic thing. On Friday, if we go down here, I'm having to move my office hours this Friday. They're on the office hour schedule. You can see them there. But I have a different meeting I have to go to in the afternoon, so I moved them to the morning. Anyway, just in case you didn't know that. Yeah, I think that's the only logistic thing I have to talk about. So let's talk about why would an object be closer than it appears? The answer has to do with our goals in a mirror. Let's consider two possible shapes for our rear view mirror. So let's consider this as our sort of top view of our mirror. One is flat and one is round. The nice thing about a flat mirror is that objects are only a little closer than they appear. Why are they a little closer than they appear? Because you are sitting back here, and so the distance your light is traveling includes going this distance twice. So it's a few feet closer than it appears. Woohoo! But the round mirror has or the curved mirror has a great advantage beyond a regular mirror. What is the advantage of the curved mirror? Yes, it can see more. Okay? So I can figure out how much I could see with this mirror based on the field of view it takes up in my sight. Right? And common mirrors are ish, I don't know, let's say the size of your hand at an arm's length away. And so that's how much of the space behind you you could see, that field of view. And if we angle it right, that would work well. But turns out that field of view is just a little too narrow to be useful for most purposes. If we make it cylindrical, you could see 360 degrees. But everything would be tiny and distorted. And so what we actually do is we commonly make them just slightly bowed. Bowed just enough to, let's say, double that field of view tends to be something that's useful. I'm not an automobile designer. I don't know how they pick the bowing they do, but they do a little bit of a bowing, which is going to make everything a little smaller, but give you more stuff you can see. And because we typically are expecting it to be flat, we often think that things are closer than they appear. Or, if you prefer the other version, even if I put a flat mirror, I might say that because I don't want somebody to back their car into something and then blame me for doing it. This is a pragmatic reason to say that, but there is actually a technical reason as well. Yes?
Is there a reason why it's only on the passenger side and not the driver side?
Ah, so this effect would be much bigger on the passenger side. And the field of view it would cover would be much smaller, right? So here I am sitting in the car. This passenger side mirror is a lot farther away, covers much less of my field of view, and I have more extra distance I'm traveling. And so I need more bow to get a good field of view, and I need to compensate for more distance traveled. Other questions? Yes? Yeah?
Related to black holes. So the first one is within a stellar. The way they got a rendering of the black hole was they got physicists to give them equations to represent black hole and just gave to rendering agents to make the black hole appear.
Yeah.
And then just if you could talk about that a little bit more and how that works in the back end, but also how was the picture of the black hole kind of taken? Because I think there's a picture that came out a year ago or 2 years ago.
All right. Black holes. We need a brief foray into general relativity. Before we foray into general relativity, I need to know our baseline. How many of you could articulate the difference between special relativity and general relativity? I could say how they are different. Okay, two. One and a half. All right. Yes. Oh, that was a three?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So a few of us, that means I should not start there. How many of you understand what special relativity does to light? I understand special relativity and light. The same three. Okay, great. I have heard of relativity before. Okay, good, good. All right, so where should we go here? We'll do a very hand-wavy explanation rather than trying the formulas. All right. Relativity deals with the space-time continuum. This is actually going to be related to something we're going to talk about here later today, which is a hypothetical four-dimensional space where one of the dimensions is time. Time does not behave like space. So when we make this space-time, we can't treat it in the standard way and get useful results. Just as one example of how space does not behave like time. If I have some moving thing, let's suppose I want to plot the positions of a ball over time. Okay? I'm going to expect I might get some, maybe I have some ball that's doing something like this. I'm going to end up with a shape sort of like this, if I can draw it properly. Why would it be fatter in the middle than at the ends? Yeah. Because it's moving slower. Do things get fatter when they move slower? And I don't just mean people tend to eat more. The problem here is that we're used to thinking about space where things are the same size in space, regardless of time. And so as I make this steeper motion, it looks thinner because our eyes are measuring the distance at a different angle. So even without dealing anywhere close to relativistic speeds, you can tell space versus time if you had the hypothetical four-dimensional solid that is all objects in the universe. But there's also a special thing that happens when the time and space have the right scaling. Because there are different kinds of measures, they're measuring different things, right? Space is measured in meters, time is measured in seconds. Those are arbitrary measures. I could just decide space is measured in miles and time in microseconds, or space is measured in millimeters and time is measured in days. There's no right calibration until we come up with special relativity. Special relativity just says the speed of light in a vacuum is a constant. What does a speed look like on this? A speed is a slope. Okay? It's actually an absolute value of a slope. And so if we want, and when we pick a speed of light as constant, then there becomes a natural definition of the right calibration. And the right calibration will make the speed of light a 45-degree angle. Okay, now, what does that mean? It means, like, we are effectively measuring space in, like, I don't know, hundreds of miles and time in milliseconds kind of thing. I mean, there's a really weird scaling for our day-to-day experience. But for very fast things, this turns out to be a useful scaling. In this scaling, we can now say we have the general principle that we're used to, that things at motion stay in motion unless acted upon by an outside force, one of Newton's laws, i.e. slopes are constant unless something pushes on the thing with the slope. Velocities don't change. But there's a weird extra that general relativity adds in. Let's suppose somewhere in space I have a very massive object. Let's just arbitrarily say it is not moving. It is very, very, very heavy, like, I don't know, the sun. Or the Earth, or something like this. General relativity says very heavy things add to space. They have more space-time. In particular, they have more time. What does that mean? Imagine this was a sheet. And I just say, around here, I need more thread going vertically. what will happen to my cloth if I put longer threads here than I do on either side? Yeah, it'll have to ripple. Okay, seersucker is a fabric that famously does this, if you happen to be familiar with your different clothing materials. Anyway, so now think about what happens. Okay, let's suppose I have these ripples here. This is hilly ground where the land on both sides of it are flat. It's sort of what's happening. Now I'm going to take myself a little cart, and I'm going to drive it here. This tire, or this wheel on the outside, is on flattish ground. The other one is having to go up and down hills. To go up and down hills is traveling farther. And so if they're spinning at the same speed, I'm going to see this thing is going to turn into the hilly ground. Because the hilly ground wheel is going to be moving slower, just like we talked about earlier for index of refraction and speed of light through thick material. We have the same thing, our speed of light through gravity areas. They turn into them because there's extra time. And so this is true of all velocities. Velocities at our scale, which we measure in, I don't know, meters per second. Velocities at cosmic scales, which we measure in multiples of the speed of light, or small fractions of the speed of light. They all will have this behavior. Everything turns towards the gravitational area. So what do we mean by a black hole? By a black hole, we mean there is so much space here that these 45-degree angles, the light, the steepest angle we can make, the steepest angle we can make will turn into this, even if it started moving away from this gravity, the turn is going to pull it back in. And it's never going to escape the hills. You can't get things moving fast enough to escape the hills. They'll just keep coming back in. This is called a black hole. Black because light can't escape it. So we can define this. This turns out we need hyperbolic geometry. The Minkowski geometry is the easiest way to simulate this in a computer. But hyperbolic geometry actually behaves very nicely from a graphics standpoint. The matrices we usually use in graphics work just fine in hyperbolic geometry. We don't even have to change them. There are some things that you have to change, but there's not a lot. So we can just sort of say, all right, instead of saying rays go in straight lines, we say rays follow whatever the formula given based on our gravity is. So the rays are now curved lines. We find those curved intersections with things, and we draw pictures. And that is how the physicists give us equations, and we throw it at the renderer, and poof, out comes a picture. The other half of this question was, how do we have photographs of black holes? We point a camera at one of these regions of space and take a picture. And we see whatever we see. But we'll see something for actually a couple of reasons. One is that there's other light around. So while some light got into the black hole and never made it out, other light never made it into the black hole. Light can orbit and slingshot around. And so we can have light from other areas that is visible there because it like whipped around and came back at us. Also, black body radiation for probably, I understand there's still some debate amongst astronomers about this, but probably the area outside of black holes spontaneously emit a radiation by destroying mass inside the black hole? Probably. Maybe not. So there's other possible sources of radiation that isn't even coming from elsewhere. But there's stuff to see. What there isn't to see is light that got inside the black hole. The other point to make here is that we have math that predicts these things should exist, that we have measured at scales that are nowhere near these things, and the math says we can never measure them directly. So how do we know they exist? We don't. But so far, we don't have problems with the math. It seems to keep working. We look at strange things, and so maybe they really exist. And maybe at some point, we'll actually get something close enough to them to measure the tidal forces that will destroy atoms and find out. All right. Any other questions? As a random aside, this space-time thing, more space and so forth. A very common trope in many fictions is things like a building that is larger on the inside than the outside. We have learned enough for you to derive what these should look like. They should have a visual phenomena. You're welcome to practice as a little experiment. What would it look like to look inside a house that was larger on the inside than the outside? What would it look like to look out of them? And similarly, another common trope in fiction is this idea that there's some mystical realm where time goes much faster or much slower. This will also have a visual effect, which you have learned enough to derive on your own. And maybe at some point, if you're curious, we can talk about how to derive that. I have never yet read a book or seen a movie or anything else that represents this visual phenomena in any way, but it's there. Anyway, all right. So, for the next 2 weeks, we're going to talk about animation. On Wednesday, this is going to mean teaching you math that the mathematicians that developed it didn't realize mattered. But it turns out, surprise, it does. So we'll talk just briefly about Cayley-Hamilton constructions and talk about quaternions and complex numbers and anyway, for the purpose of dealing with rotations in animation. But today we're going to start with just the general ideas of animation, some things to think about, including one idea we already talked about, that time and space are different. We're going to talk about some very simple animations called easings, and then some things artists want in animations. And depending on how things go, we'll start talking about how we build real animations and maybe briefly preview homework 4 to get you thinking about some of the things that might be going on there. So, let's start thinking about animation. I already said we could take space-time and treat it as a four-dimensional solid. Let's suppose we had such a four-dimensional solid, right? So we have our z-axis and we have our y-axis, and we have our x-axis, and we have our t-axis. Oh no, how can I write 4 axes? Well, how could I even do 3? I'm drawing on a two-dimensional space. Anyway, let's suppose we have this four-dimensional solid. What would we do with it? The concept of what we're doing is we're taking slices at some t, which gives us an xyz solid, just slice through at some time, and then we're drawing that solid. Hey, this is the general concept. I have never seen any animation system that lets you do this. No tool you'll sit down and says, here is your four-dimensional solid. Edit it freely. Although they could, right? But they don't. So instead, we're going to see a very different interface for various reasons, largely having to do with artists. So we'll talk some about how artists come along here. But I also want to mention something like, this isn't the right view. So let's imagine a simplified one-dimensional world, where we have x going this way and t going this way. And let's suppose this represents my animation. It has a particular duration and a particular size. If I'm thinking about what a camera does, cameras do not draw slices of this. They have to have a non-zero time. Not just because it's really hard to make things the shutter open for an infinitesimal amount of time, but if we did open it for an infinitesimal amount of time, no light would come in. So we always have to average the light over a period of time. And this is just a characteristic of anything that senses light, has to average it over a period of time. Now our eyes almost get around this, because our eyes will measure exactly which time each of the cones sensed light. And so our eyes are very close to acting like they are instantaneous in their results. But any sort of other device that we might happen to pick, any device that isn't directly wired into our brain, is going to have this more complicated scenario where we're having to integrate light over time. And if we think about early cameras, early video cameras, we call them film, which just means a thin thing. We had rolls of film. We would put them in big spools and we would spin them past an opening. But if we just take a roll of film, let's just imagine this world where we have a roll of film that is passing by some opening into the world, and we just spin it past, what will we end up seeing? A bunch of blurs. Okay, there is nothing to make any particular piece of the film only catch one direction, even if we have a good lens array in front of it. That each piece of film passes over that space. And so what we do in addition to this is we have a rolling shutter. Okay, so we put in front of this, or somewhere in here, we put effectively a great big circle that has an opening. And that spins with the film. And so each frame, each region we expect the picture to happen, will have just a very brief time when light flashes into it. And then the shutter will be closed, and it'll scroll down, and then the next one will get a flash of light. And this gives us some good pictures. There are some extra tricks we can do to try to make this useful, more useful. You can actually have the lens jiggle and things to make to remove some motion and get longer exposures and so on. But this is the basic idea of old film cameras. And so because of this, what happens is we think about our time scale in old film cameras is we have these periodic narrow bands of integration where we're getting all of the things that happened over this time all in the same picture. And then we have a period with nothing, and then another period where everything is in the same picture, and another period with nothing. And we use the same process to project them in movie theaters. So old movie theaters, most of the time, were pitch black. And you have flashes of the same duration as the exposure, typically, where we would project light, and then we'd stop. We just did the same thing, except instead of having a light receptor here, we had a bulb. Otherwise, the same construct. So this was early films, technically how we made them. Weird amounts of this have stuck into current systems. And part of it has to do with useful things. But the main thing we get out of this space here is we get what we call motion blur. Okay, so if I have a still circle in the scene, it may be in the same place over that whole time. But if it is rapidly moving, it may sort of blur out in both directions of its motion. It'll be smeared across that period of time because it's moving. And so this behavior of motion blur was an artifact, an undesirable, nobody sat down and said whether they wanted it or not, but it was an artifact of how early film was captured. And it became standard. When other techniques for capturing images came along, we started trying to replicate this. So we think about a digital camera. Digital cameras accept light all the time. And so if we were to think about this, we'd have motion blur that covers the entire gap between frames. But people are so used to seeing this kind, that looks too motion blurred. And so high-end video cameras will actually intentionally discard some of that time to make the motion blurs smaller. They will simulate the old system of taking periods where they're exposure and period where they're not in order to get the effects that the old chemical cameras had. That each generation has been familiar with one technology. When the next one comes along, we want it to look like that most of the time. So this is a thing. Motion blur is inevitable of some kind, is inevitable in any capture system, because we can't get light over a zero time window. So we always have some. But there is this sort of expectation that something like a quarter of your frame duration is what you want. Yeah. And there's no reason why that should be the case, except history. Okay. So, motion blur is important enough that it is actually fairly common to add it. To scenes. If you think about our rasterizer, nothing in our rasterizer, homework 2, will give us motion blur. Because we're solving math about where the triangle is, and it won't give us, like, it's sort of here. So there's actually systems whereby we will render the velocity of each pixel as an extra buffer. We have red, green, blue, depth, and velocity. And then we'll post-process based on the velocity of each pixels. We'll smear the scene to create motion blur. There is also, in ray tracing, we will commonly take our anti-aliased pixel, we'll shoot each of those rays a slightly different time. So we can generate sampled motion blur, because people want to see it, usually. Okay. Now, another thing that is important to understand when we're thinking about animation, and is also historical, comes from the first industrial scale animation systems. Before we had computers, how did we do animations? We just drew pictures, right? So if you wanted to have somebody smiling and then realizing, wait a minute, maybe I shouldn't be smiling, you would draw a bunch of pictures. Right? And you would show them at the right speed and draw them more closely than each other than this, right? You may have done this with flip books. Okay? In early animations, you had an artist do the animation. But not all artists are equally expensive. You could argue why this is. Some are better than others. Some are better trusted than others. Some have more power than others. However you want to do this. When animation started becoming sort of industrial scale, what we realized is not all of these pictures are equally important. So for example, in this series of pictures, I will argue the least important picture is this one. If I give somebody this picture and that picture, I expect just anybody to be able to draw the picture that is in between them. And if we get more complicated things, we start to realize that in an animation, there are certain frames that are more important than the others. Certain frames that, given these frames at these times, they sort of define what the animation can do. Okay? This is actually true of regular physical motion. Let's suppose I want to pump my fist in the air. When I think about this action, I might think about where I'm going to start. I might think about where I'm going to stop. I never think about, is this the right position for my arm in between, or is this better? I didn't think about those in-between motions in my own body, let alone when I'm doing animation. I don't want to think about them. And so what ends up happening is we have this idea of the key frames. Key frames tend to be the most extreme and the stillest. This is not guaranteed, but in general, as you're thinking about this, if you haven't already done animation, these are the general properties you have. They are the extreme bounds of motion, and in general, they also tend to be the places where we pause, or the places where we're changing from one direction of motion to another. And so because of the stillest, they get the most eye attention, and because of the most extremes, they define the motion. And so early physical animators realized we're going to divide our people, our artists, into two groups. There is the group that is going to draw the key frames. And then they're the expensive animators. And then we're going to hand those key frames off to the cheap animators who are going to fill in all of the in-betweens. And we called them tweeners because they made the in-betweens. And so we have the key frames who we call the animators. They define how the animation works. And the in-betweeners, or the tweeners, who do the rest of the work to make it into an animation. This idea is baked into every computer animation software I could find. I have searched around to try to find one that does not have keyframes and in-betweening, and couldn't find one. There's no intrinsic reason why you would have to design an interface with keyframes and in-betweening, but in practice, this is what happens. Okay? And so what do we expect the artist to do? We expect the artist to go into the software and carefully design the keyframe to be exactly what they want. This is the exact pose we should have here, and this is the exact pose we should have there. Computer, figure out the rest. This is the basic interface of most animation software. And so part of our job as computer scientists, computer graphics developers, is to write software to be the cheap animator. Write software that does the tweening. And so that's what we're going to spend some time talking about, how we do. How do we program tweening? There are a few other things we'll sometimes want to do, but that's going to be one of the biggest things we're going to have to do as we're designing and implementing animation. Questions about the history before we start going into the math? Okay. Let's suppose these are two keyframes. Sketch the frame that goes halfway in between. I suppose I shouldn't make the head dramatically different size, should I? Seeing a lot of puzzled or frustrated looks. And okay, this is not an art class, right? But these are not complicated sketches, I would argue. Why is this hard? Yes?
The line segments kind of overlap with each other, so you have to, like, when I'm taking like the average of each line segment for like the back, the hand is kind of in the way and it makes things more confusing.
Yeah, so the image itself is confusing, trying to pick out the different pieces. Yeah?
It's not easy to map like what part of the initial image, where it is.
Yeah, I haven't given you a frame, so you don't know where everything is. Yeah?
Also balancing out like the motion, so I guess kind of the position of where things would end up in between.
Yeah, so there's this implicit suggestion that things move in physical ways, biological ways, which I just assume you can figure out. What else? Yeah?
Yeah, I guess you kind of have to assume that it's like a linear transition of like points, or if there's some sort of like fast part, like where would the middle be?
Right, right. So is it moving smoothly, or is it some of it accelerating? What's halfway? Is it all, maybe this part's accelerating and that part isn't, and so halfways could be different for different parts of the image? What else? This is enough to go with. I'll remind you of something that you were almost certainly told when you're first learning to program. Still is true. If you can't do it, you can't make the computer do it. Okay? We're going to have to define how to solve all of these problems. We don't have to physically be able to draw, but if we don't know what should be in the middle, how are we supposed to tell the computer to compute what should be in the middle? Okay? So let's start to try to understand some principles we want to have when we're dealing with animation, when we're dealing with this process of tweening. However, we're going to start with something way simpler than a running figure. We're going to start with another kind of tweening. Imagine this is my computer screen, and this is a window in my computer screen. And I press the minimize button. What happens when you minimize a window? There's this little animation of it shrinking and going somewhere. Hey, there didn't used to be. When I was in classes like this, nobody animated the windows moving. Why would you waste resources on something like that? You press the minimization button and just poof, it vanishes. It's there one frame, gone the next. Turns out there's various reasons why this is not a good visual cue. We learn from animation. Adding in, say, 3 frames of animation that shows where it's going causes people new to the system to think, oh, it went down there. Let me go find it down there. Right? And this is an important part of user interface design. If you take a user interface class, hopefully they'll talk about. So let's talk first about user interface style animation. The most simple one to talk about is what's called the easing curve. So this is a page just about named easing curves. What is an easing curve? When I want something to move from place to place, I want a window, or I want the corners of the windows to go from where they are to down in the taskbar. I need to decide how quickly they move. And these are the standard easing curves. There's actually surprising numbers of places in most user interfaces you can name these when you want to move something from something else. The horizontal axis is time. The vertical axis is space in all of these curves. Let's see what that means. I'm going to put my mouse over the ease in sign. And you'll notice on the right, it shows me how things move. And I can pick any of these I want. Okay? And there's a lot of these. We've got funky ones, like this one. And this one. And this one. Right? There's no limit to what the shape can be. This is the kind of thing we think about with a 2-frame. There are only 2 keyframes. There is no extra information. There's no geometry. There's no physical laws. I just need to move from here to here over time. How do I do that? Okay? And we can pick what we want. There are reasons we might pick each of them. In general, the slow part, we will know, will initially attract our attention. The fast part, we don't have to spend time thinking about. And so something like the ease in out circ mostly is at the two ends. And it does connect the two, but it's mostly at the two ends. If I do something like the ease out bounce, the jiggling at the end will cause my eye to notice that end position. And so we'll focus much more on where we end up and that there's some level of precision there by having little sharp divots than other things. So there's a lot of these approaches we can handle, and there's user interface reasons why some of them are good and some of them are bad. There's also some that I don't think I've ever seen. I can't remember the last time I saw ease in elastic used in anything other than a completeness here, all of them demo. Okay. But when we're doing our tweening, we have to decide how do we go from one to the other. What's the starting and ending velocity? What happens in between? Do we overshoot and correct? Do we not? These are decisions we're going to have to make. If I wanted to draw this page, this is a bunch of 2D images. So I would use, for example, the homework one rasterizer. What technique would you use to draw this page, ignoring the text? How would you specify the input? Yes?
For all of them together?
Sure, or each of them. I want to have a smallish input file. How could I get a smallish input file? Yeah, there's a lot of pieces, so it's not going to be a tiny file. And there's not going to be a whole lot of tricks I can do for boxes. But the curves I could probably do. What's a good way of drawing these curves? Sorry?
Bezier.
Bezier is our curve of choice, and it will be our curve of choice for doing these in animation. Okay? Most animation systems I was able to find use Bezier curves for the time change. Horizontal is time, vertical is position. We may have many different axes. Okay? But they're going to have Bezier curves under the hood. Let's remind slash teach you something about Bezier curves. It was true in what we said, but I realized from various interactions that it doesn't always click in. A Bezier curve, regardless of its number of control points, but in animation you almost always use three, I specify a set of points. Two of these points, always two, regardless of the number of control points, two of these points will end up on the curve. The first and the last. And not only will the first and the last end up on the curve, the tangents of the first and the last will end up the tangents of the curve at that point. This turns out to be important. There are places where the artist told us more information. We want those end control points of our Beziers to be the keyframes. This is where the artist told us where things go. We don't want to change the keyframes. If the artist says, this is the first keyframe and that's the last keyframe, and we say we're changing them both so we'll get a smoother animation, they'll usually be upset. So when we're designing our systems, we're going to ease, it turns out, a lot of things from one keyframe to another. The X, the Y, the Z of every point. Maybe also color, maybe also other material effects, maybe lots of things we could ease. Each of them is going to be given by keyframes by the artists, which are going to be the end points of a Bezier. And then we're going to pick the initial tangents based on our best guess at the desired motion. The most common way of doing this, let's suppose the artist gave me three keyframes, keyframe one, keyframe two, and keyframe three. I know the endpoint of the Bezier from 1 to 2 and the endpoint of the Bezier from 2 to 3. But that leaves me with two extra control points I need for each of those Beziers. Where do I put them? Now, we have seen other examples of making a nice smooth set of Bezier curves out of control points, the B-spline. We don't want the B-spline. The B-spline does not reach control point 2, which is a problem. So we're not going to do that. We're going to do some simpler kind of spline. And the most common simplification we can think of is to think about control point 2, I'm going to figure out the offset between the one before and after it, the offset between 1 and 3. And I'm going to add a portion of that offset on each side of 2 to get 2's neighboring control points. The idea here is that this is going to be something like smooth. Or some definition of smooth. The things on either side of them are sort of what the curve would have done if this point wasn't here. And we're going to assume that is by the mean value theorem, I think, from calculus. There must be something that has that slope, so we'll put it there. Anyway, so this is the general idea. And at the end, we'll usually do some sort of approximation. We'll just throw a control point halfway in between. And then that will give us our Bezier curve. Okay? Two of them. Usually, most systems I have seen, the artist will say, here's keyframe, here's keyframe, here's keyframe, here's keyframe. The system will build these Beziers for them, but then there will be some sort of power user interface where the artist can go in and change these. And we'll see these when we talk more about artist interfaces next week. But typically, Beziers over time are how we're actually going to deal with the system. Now, I drew this Bezier in space because we have two-dimensional space. So there's another important thing to understand about a Bezier, which is they decompose. So if I think about this Bezier as being an x, y coordinate as a function of time, I realize this is not how you're used to writing functions, but I can write functions this way. Sorry. X, y coordinate over time, these fully decompose. This is just an x over time and a y over time, which are both Beziers. And the math we used here works independently for the x and the y. We can figure out this tangent thing and so forth in x and y separately. We can do it all in x and y separately. So we have this full decomposition. So while the artist is thinking about three-dimensional positions, we're thinking about each coordinate separately when we're moving things around. Questions so far? OK. The next important thing to understand about animation. Oh, let's actually briefly talk about how we actually do this. When people do the collapsing window down to the edge, we don't have enough frames. We don't want it to take a long time to move down there. It is common to make this take 2 or 3 frames. 2 or 3 frames is not enough for the eye to follow. And so many systems will actually do like fake animation. They will do something like, I will have a frame that draws several boxes like this. That will be one of my frames. And then the next frame might have the boxes like this. And then the next frame will have nothing. We are smearing them together. We're motion blurring-ish, but blur confuses people, so we actually do them like individual. Like, not all systems do this, but many systems will do this sort of, we're going to cheat, which you could learn more about in user interface. We're not going to talk about a great deal right now. But let's come back to this system. All right. The artist gives me some keyframes. I want to get between them. There is one other really important thing the artist almost always wants, which is physics. Okay, let's consider an example of where physics would be violated. Let's suppose the artist gives me one system where the key points are this, and the other where the key points are this. Since I only have 2 things, let's just assume I do linear interpolation. So I'm just going to move this point straight to there, and this point straight to there. And if I think about the midpoint here, that is the wrong solution there, even if I could draw it straight. What is wrong with this solution? Yeah? It changes size. Oh no. We don't want that. Okay? We want what are called rigid transformations. We at least had a quiz that defined this. I missed the day to know how much it was talked about in class. What is a rigid transformation? Yes? Does not transform the length or magnitude. Rotates and translates, not scales. Okay? But this is an interesting point. I have not scaled either point. I have only translated them. So is this rigid? And the answer is no, but it's not obvious why. It is not rigid even though the points are moving with rigid transforms. It's not rigid because we have this assumption of a physical rigid object. We see this as being a rigid thing. When I draw a more complicated shape, you see some of it is rigid and some of it is not. You see the things look sort of like straight lines. This is rigid and this is rigid, but the point in between is not rigid. And you just understand this because you understand what I'm trying to draw. Computers are not super clever at figuring out what I was trying to draw. And so we need the artist to tell us what was rigid. So the artist is going to tell us what we're going to call bones. Now, this is an example, again, of computer jargon being based on English and not really meaning what English means. But it's not far from English in this case. A bone is an expression of the idea that some region is rigid. So, let's look at skeletal animation. Yeah, this is a reasonable picture. Let's look at this one. Here's a snapshot of some 3D graphics program. I can't tell which one from this picture. Oh, looks like down here, like this is Blender. Huzzah. All right. This shows this outer surface is a polygonal surface, has a lot of polygons. It might be NURBS, but I think it's polygonal, because Blender usually does polygons, not NURBS. And then we have drawn, actually inside, physically these will be underneath the surface, but we draw them on top so you can see them. We have these bones. The bones are represented by this chain of points. We're only allowed to change things about them at the intersection of two bones. And so an artist will create models, commonly actually in major systems, will be divided into different artists, but there will be an artist called the rigger who creates the rig. That is to say, puts the bones in place and does more than this. The rigger will tell me things like elbows can't bend backwards. He'll give me constraints on the bones. And they'll express all of this information so that when I'm thinking about animating, animating is really going to break down into two different concepts. One is, actually we can say three. One is, where are the objects overall? Position and rotate the objects in the scene. They might move in their entirety. The second is, how are the bones being animated? Ignore the geometry, just deal with the bones by themselves. All they have is position and orientation, and their position is relative to the bone before them. And then the third step is, given where those bones have moved to, where should I put each vertex? That's called skinning. So for example, these vertices near the knuckle want to be influenced by both of the bones underneath them. Right? Both the bone before and the bone after should change where the knuckle appears, the knuckle vertices appear, where some other vertices back here on the forearm may be influenced only by the bone near them. And so we have some technique of, one, move the bones around, tween the bones, and then given where the bones are, assign the vertices. Yes?
Is it possible to set how rigid something is, like to
allow the bones? Great question. So in theory, yes. But in practice, the way we do this is by making a bunch of bones and just say these joints can't move very much. And why is that the practice? There's nothing that stops us from making curves, but the math gets a lot more complicated. As we start to talk about some of the constraints and so on we put on bones, we'll start to see why having curved things just makes it more complicated to describe. It's also harder for the user interface to say how bendy should they be. But you will see systems that have things called bendy bones, which are under the hood lots of small bones with some sort of try to keep them mostly stiff constraint. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about how we do this. Let's start with just one bone as a starter. If I have some bone, we commonly draw them as lines, but we actually want to know how they're twisted as well. So we're going to have the full 3D orientation of the bone. It's going to have all of its axes specified. One bone by itself, we're going to think of, instead of as having two points, we're going to think of it as having a position and an orientation. The two parts of the rigid transformation matrices. The translation part and the rotation part. However, this is not going to be enough. The matrices we have learned are not going to solve our problems. Let's just briefly think about why. Let's consider a 2D matrix That's a 3D because three-dimensional because homogeneous coordinates. Let's suppose I start from the rest position. And then I want to change this to, we're going to rotate it 180 degrees. Not moving it. If you give me these two matrices and I start to interpolate between them using anything, I can use Bezier curves in the coordinates, I can do linear interpolation, pick your technique of choice, I have a problem that the things in between these are scaling matrices, not rotation matrices. But even if I normalize them in some way to make them rotation matrices again, I'll just end up with, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, poof, now I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. I don't get anything like rotation out of this. Matrices are a very bad form of rotation for the purpose of animation. And so in class on Wednesday, we're going to learn about quaternions, which are a much nicer system for doing this at the expense of being weird math. Okay? So we're not going to do matrices for orientation. We are just going to use XYZ for our position. Okay? So that's going to work out just fine if we have only one bone. So this is not good. We're going to use quaternions instead. Let me write that down in case somebody is scanning the slides. Okay? The other thing we're going to have is we want to have, let's just consider a very simple two-bone system. Let's suppose this is a knee bone. Let's go ahead and throw a foot down here. Why not? In general, I want to treat, when the artist is rigging this, they're going to tell me what the origin of the bones is. And for most skeletal systems, we think about bones rotating around one of their ends. I think about my forearm rotating around the elbow, not around the center of the arm. Okay? So I'm typically going to think about, okay, the hip, this is the origin of the hip. And I expect rotating the hip to move the calf and the foot. Okay? And so the position of the calf, the position of the calf's origin is relative to the coordinate frame of the hip. So I'm going to say the calf is going to be in the thigh's coordinate system. Not in the world coordinate system. And then the thigh might be in the pelvis's coordinate system, and the pelvis might be in the object's, the creature's coordinate system, and so forth. And so to figure out where a toe goes, right, here I have my toe. My toe might go through a whole series. I mean, it has a joint inside of it, and then there's a joint down here. Depending on how flexible your foot is, we might care about that joint. We have this joint. It turns out we actually have two bones in the calf, so they can sort of rotate in weird ways. We have this whole series of things we might have to handle to figure out exactly where the toe goes. What's the rotation of the hip, and the knee, and the ankle, maybe the foot if we have a flexible foot, and the base of the toe, and maybe the middle joint of the toe if we have a flexible toe. We're going to combine all of those, each of them defining a coordinate system for the next, to end up figuring out where the toe goes. However, if we do that work, then we're going to have a very nice property. That is to say, our tweening, our native tweening, we're going to tween the orientations and the positions in their local coordinate frames, and things are going to look right. They're going to move naturally-ish. They aren't going to minimize energy and have tendons and muscles and so on, but they are going to move in a relatively intuitive way. It's going to keep the thing we created looking like the thing we meant to create. Questions? Yes?
What about bones that twist around each other?
Yeah, great question. So bones are really complicated. So for example, I have two bones in my forearm, and if I twist my hand, it's the bones in my forearm that are moving. They're rotating around each other. The most common way of modeling that is we just pretend it's one bone that can spin in the middle. So we let it spin in all three axes. However, the skinning of that becomes more complicated. And so actually a common way of handling that, let's consider our arm, okay? So here I have my arm. A common way of doing that is I'll make a split in the bone here. And I will say this bone can only rotate around the elbow, and this bone can only rotate around. And this will give me the base and the tip's orientation, which I can then use to do my skinning. Other questions? Should comment. How many bones are in your body? 200 and some. Depends on if you count the ear and how well. Anyway, how many bones do you suppose is in an average rig? We vote for more than that. Where are those bones? Try to count the bones you think define your motion. Just count your body. How many bones, if you were rigging, how many bones would you put for your body? Does anybody have a count? Yeah? 20 to 30? Anybody have a larger count than that? 60? 40? 60? That's so many less than 200. Where are all the others? How many ribs do you have? How many vertebrae do you have? How many bones are in your wrist? Right? There's a lot of bones that do have mechanical function. And if I really care about making a mechanically accurate model of a human, I'll need to model all of those bones. The chance they'll need to model the bones inside my ear, very low. The chance I'll need to model things in my wrist, a little lower. The chance I'll need to model each of my metaphalangae, maybe. If I'm going to do some sort of like trying to deal with the fact that my hand is actually capable of twisting, right? The hand, the palm itself is flexible. That's caused by having these four different metaphalangae, right? So there's different techniques, different levels of detail we can deal with. And then we had some people saying more. We usually will add more because we'll add extra bones just to make the rigging easier. Okay? So for example, I am capable of moving my knee back and forth, but not very much unless I have to move either my hip or my foot. And so it is relatively common to see in rigs, there's this like fake bone floating out in front of my leg, whose sole purpose is to say, this is where the knee is pointing. Point the knee at that magic fake bone. And then that bone might have another fake bone. I may also say, oh, I have all of these bones in the finger, but I want to have just like one magic fake bone that's just how closed is my fist. I'm going to swing the close the fist bone, and all these other bones will move using some math. And if I want to tweak it, I can tweak the ones inside. So for the purpose of animating, we'll add fake bones to deal with larger scale phenomena, but we'll also skip individual bones that were unlikely to ever need to move the fourth rib independently of the others. So having a bone for the fourth rib is very unlikely, right? And so we have this sort of different levels of what we're doing. And if we really, really care, we can even try to do like a physics simulation of what is bone. If I am tasked with animating somebody having a compound fracture, I need to understand how bones break, right? And so there's often these multiple levels. We may even have multiple completely different models for the same figure that are boned and skinned in different ways to deal with different parts of the animation process. Okay. Now, let's talk about skinning. Let's suppose I have my bones, I have figured out what my bones want to do. And let's just take a very simple skin to start with. Let's actually suppose I modeled this in a straight position. And in the straight position, let's say I have a vertex here, and here, and here, and here. We're only going to consider just these four vertices for now. I now need to decide where those vertices go in the rotated position. The simplest way of doing this, not always the way it's done, but commonly the way it's done, is I simply have weights. I pick each vertex, and I decide how much it is dictated by each bone. So maybe I say this is about dictated entirely by that bone. Maybe this one is dictated, I don't know, 3/4 by that bone and 1/4 by this bone, and so on. I assume the artist or the rigger, most commonly, sometimes there will be a separate skinner, has picked these weights for me. Once they have picked the weights, I have figured out where the bones go, or the artist has told me, either come from the artist or my tweening of the artist's work. I now need to position those vertices. Fortunately, what I have for each bone is a position and an orientation. And I can turn those into a matrix. And so I'm going to treat these points in the basis of wherever they were supposed to be and say, okay, that means that point is now there because it was entirely based on this. Now, what about this point, this mix of the two? The most common method here is I just do each of those independently. I say, well, this bone says it should be here. And this bone says it should be there. And then I said it's 3/4 this bone, 1/4 that bone, so I'm going to put it there instead. Okay? And this is the basic concept of tweening. I just need to figure out where each vertex is in each bone and then weight them based on which bone was influencing them. This is not perfect. Okay? So think about the skin on your elbow or knee. We'll use elbow because I don't want to pull up my trousers. Right? It is difficult to find a position where it's a linear combination. You can actually put your finger on part of the skin and you'll realize some of them seem to sort of stay put, some of them are being pulled in by tendons, some of them are rolling over something. Because under the hood, you've got stuff, and skin is being stretched over the stuff. It gets even weirder if you think about muscles, which physically bulge, and fat, which flaps, and all of these other things that your body does. You have something called a kneecap. Anybody happen to know the purpose of the kneecap? Yeah.
Legs don't shatter when you run.
So your legs don't shatter when you run. Hooray! Although it'd be pretty cool animation if they did. Anyway, for some definition of cool. So how? But the kneecap is physically embedded in a tendon, and is rolling over the joint. And then the skin is rolling over the kneecap. We have all these complicated motions to get that final surface. How much we care about that varies a lot. And I might need to do a full physical simulation. So high-end models actually simulate muscles and tendons and bones and fat and so on. We're not going to talk about how to do most of that yet. We may talk a little bit about it later. There's a very simple way of letting the artist fudge it for us. And that is, on top of these components, we're going to have one extra thing. We are going to have a pose. Different libraries have different names for this. This is not as universal as some of the other terms like bone and skeleton and rig. But here's an idea. In addition to saying this point is weighted by these other two things, I am also going to have an offset that is keyed by the orientation of this bone. So I'm going to call this, let's call this 180 because it's at 180 degrees. This is 90, maybe I'm probably closer to 80, I drew there. I can just take that angle and I can use that like a time component to look up an animation of the surface vertices. So I'm going to have keyframes keyed not on time but on orientation of bones for the vertices that go over top. And so then, if the artist says, oh dear, it looks like my elbow deflated when I bent my arm, they can then go in there, bend the arm, and pull the vertices back out where they want and say, make a pose keyframe. And now, in addition to, I'm going to start with this interpolation, then I'm going to offset it based on that pose, and we can fix this system. Okay? So not all systems do this, because the really high-end ones will actually simulate everything under the hood, but this is a common way of trying to trick things. The other thing I can do is I can say, I'm going to add a kneecap bone that I'm just going to fix to be, it is always halfway as bent as the knee. So I don't have, the artist never has to specify it. It starts flat and then it bends half as much as the knee, but because it is rotating rigidly, I now have this smooth rounding motion instead of this sudden linear motion, and I can add as many of those as I want. So if I want to make something very smooth, I could add 10 of these little kneecap-like bones, each keyed to some combination of the angles of the other bones, and then key off some of the vertices there. So there's all kinds of little tricks the artist can do, and that we can let the artist do to make this work more smoothly. Whew. All right, last comments, questions so far? Yes?
I see how we're doing this with like the physical body parts, but what about something that's not the body, so like a car moving?
Great question. How about a car? How many bones would your car have? We have a vote for one. Can we think of more than one bone in your car? Yeah. You have five? What are your other four?
Your wheels.
So the wheels spin. I could do those individually or collectively. Instantly, can the back two wheels spin individually?
Yes,
there's even a device called a differential to make this happen. Anyway, all right, cars are more complicated than you probably thought. Anyway, yeah, but we'll have bones for the wheels, and you have doors and windshield wipers, but you're not going to have a whole lot. The skinning of cars is really easy. Pretty much everything is all on one bone or all on the other bone. Right? There's very little that isn't. If we really care about the behavior inside the car, crankshafts and pistons and so on, we're going to have separate bones that are targeting other bones that are constrained in various ways. And that definition of constraints is what allows a simple thing to create complicated motion. Similar to this idea of the knee, where just a fixed offset of the angle, I can also say, always point this at that thing or so on to get some of those more complicated behaviors. Other questions? All right, there is something this just doesn't do that is really important. Squash and stretch. Let's actually look at this here because, you know, everybody likes this picture. One of the earliest known animations made by a camera. This is actually made by having a bunch of cameras along a racetrack that took photographs and then reassembling them. Why am I showing this to you? Observe the length of the torso of the horse. Is the length of the torso of the horse constant? No. What? How does the horse do that? Does it have telescope bones? It turns out we have things like cartilage and so on in our bodies as well. We are not rigid. We're sort of rigid. Bones are slightly elastic, right? There's various things that don't behave this way. And so there's this general principle of what's called squash and stretch that's often exaggerated in cartoony animation, but still present in the regular world, where things tend to stretch out in the direction of motion and flatten when they're changing direction. And so there's other kinds of things we might want to add to our animation. Incidentally, also often implemented using Beziers, but in a different way. We're going to have three-dimensional grids of Beziers that we'll get to talk about another day because we're out of time for today. So we have not finished talking about all the things that there are to talk about. We've got to a lot of it. Okay? The basic pieces of what we're doing, we're going to have to figure out how to get from keyframe to keyframe. So we're going to do the tweening using some sort of easing that is typically a Bezier curve. We're going to combine things up in this hierarchy of bones, each of which defines a coordinate system for the others. And we're going to have these processes to hook them all together. When we come back on Wednesday, we're going to dive into the math of quaternions. I will see you all on Wednesday.